do have Hebrews chapter 11, right in front of you. Again, this is the Blue Bible. It's page 1209. Just thinking about the first seven verses. I can't remember what it was, but this year or maybe last year, Jane and I got invited to a party. And we went to this party, and it happened to be in my old secondary school, which was quite a bizarre experience. I haven't been there for, I can't even work out, 25 years. Anyway, so quite bizarre. But as we were, it was in the main hall, and as we were having this disco party in this hall where I was meant to be dressed as 17th point, I can't remember that. Anyway, I noticed on the wall these wooden plaques. And you may have seen those. They were kind of a list of people. On one plaque, there was a list of all the previous headmasters. Another plaque, there was all the previous head boys and head girls. And on another plaque, there was a list of, I think he called it something like notable alumni. People who had really made it. You know, people who had really made it. But you say there's Roger Bannister, first person near the 4 minute mile. He was up there. Jason Dodd, Southampton, football, Paul Tisdale, the year older than me, Southampton, Kurt Smith, Tears for Fears, he went there, Andrew Lincoln, the actor, anyone know him? He was there, I can't remember, he's on some programme, he's a year ahead of me, Jason Gardner, old Olympic, gold medal winner, Danny Bird, no DJ. Anyway, he was all there, and you'll be surprised, well you won't be surprised probably, to learn that my name was absent from that list. If only they knew, but they didn't know, so there we go. But these are the school's heroes, aren't they? Their success is in some way the school's success, and they like to claim that it's all because of the school. Now, no doubt, as all these little boys, me included, were sat around in this hall, we were meant to be inspired by these plaques of people's names up on the wall, you know? They wanted us to think that if we were really worked hard, that we too could be numbered among the few people who had our names listed on a round wooden plaque on the side of the school. Maybe they thought that, you know, some of that inspiration would rub off on us. Well, at first glance, Hebrews 11 could seem a little bit like that, couldn't it? A list of names, people who really made it, people who really, you know, the cream of God's people, a list of heroes who made it into God's book, not just Peter and Cliff. God's book, the creator of the universe, has written a book, and in it he's listed a load of names, a load of people who are there to inspire us and help us to perform better. And in chapter 6, verse 12, the writer does want us to learn from those who have gone before. He says this, "We do not want you to become lazy, but to imitate those who through faith and patience inherit what has been promised." And if you remember back to chapter 6, you might remember that I said, well, we'll have a look at that in chapter 11. Well, here we are. We're going to have a look at all these people who are there for us to imitate. So here they are, but rather than being like a list of exceptional people, that they're there to demonstrate, I believe, what is normal for God's people. These aren't just like, you know, a list of heroes who really made it, and if we're lucky, we can find our name one day. They're there to show us what faith looks like. Persevering faith is part of normal Christian life. See, if you were here last week, we saw that, didn't we? Right at the end. We do not belong to those, he's talking about everyone, who shrink back and destroy, but to those who have faith and are saved. It's simple. It's either faith and saved, or no faith and destroyed. It's not faith and saved, and, you know, if you're really keen, you get your name on a list. No, it's faith and saved. No faith and destroyed. So this list of people isn't really a hall of fame. It's not a list of heroes who, if we really make it, we might become a bit like. These are here to show us what persevering faith looks like. Now let me just remind you of the context a little bit, because I think that comes out more And you'll remember that Hebrews was written probably by an absent pastor to a church or a group of churches who were facing persecution. We saw that last week. They'd had their stuff confiscated. They'd been put in prison. And they'd been treated unjustly and publicly insulted. They were experiencing persecution. And their temptation was to go back, to keep their heads down. Culture's changing. I'm going to keep my head down. I'm going to go back into Judaism. I'm going to start relying again on all of that where it's safe. And he's saying to them, no, that isn't how it works. He showed us that Jesus is actually the fulfillment of everything that you're going back to. He's the great high priest. He is the apostle that we all need. Actually, to go to shrink back is to be destroyed. That's what he's saying. Now, as I keep saying, because it's true, there aren't many of us who are likely to shrink back into Judaism to save our skin. But, you know, it doesn't take much that's been on the news, and if you've been looking at the news this week, you'll see that evangelical Christianity is under attack. It is in our world today, and it's getting worse. I can remember when I was at school, I was in a junior school, and we had this, she was a Canadian woman coming in to teach us about sort of visitor, and she taught us about the boa constrictor. I don't know if you know anything about boa constrictors, they're massive snakes, and the way they kill their prey is to wrap themselves around their prey, and slowly and surely tighten their grip so as the prey breathes in. But that is kind of what's happening, isn't it, in our society? As we get on and on, we can feel the grip of secular thinking squeeze the life out of Christianity. What is it that we need? Well, we need persevering faith. We've got to think about it now. We need faith that perseveres. It's the only thing actually that's going to save. So what does persevering faith look like? Well, I want to bring out five things this morning. And just to warn you, I'm not going verse one, verse two, verse three. It's going to be kind of like picking out five themes that I think we see from these verses. And the first thing I think we can see is that faith can't see, but it isn't blind. Faith can't see, but it isn't blind. Have a look at verse 1. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. See, faith can't see. And then as soon as you say that, you have all the people in the new atheist camp who call that what they might consider blind faith. For example, Christopher Hitchens writes, religious faith is ultimately grounded in wishful thinking. And is that true? But that isn't what this text is saying. You see, we've got to understand, I think, what we mean by hope, what Bible means by hope. See, in our language, we use hope in this kind of way, don't we, of wishful thinking. You know, it's my birthday in November, and I really hope it doesn't rain. Yeah, is that likely? Well, I don't know. I mean, it may or it may not. So I've got absolutely no idea, but I hope it doesn't. Or, you know, I'd like to be with you tomorrow, but I might get a better offer. Or I might be ill, so I might not. See, hope has that kind of idea, doesn't it, in our language, in English, of being kind of a wishful kind of thinking. But that's not what the Bible means. The Bible doesn't use hope in that way. See, biblical Christian hope is a hope that is certain. It's based on the promise of God and on the word of God. So we can be confident in what we hope for and sure about what we cannot see because God has said it. That's biblical hope. Faith is not non-rational and it's not irrational. It's a calculation that God is faithful and that God will do it. Again, this the context, as I've said, of this chapter is all about trusting God to bring about what he has promised. Let me read out chapter 6, verse 12 again. We do not want you to become lazy, but to imitate those who not seeing, for me to say that faith doesn't see is not the same as saying faith is blind. Right? You understand what I'm saying? There's lots of things that I can't see, because their future or they exist somewhere else in the world. I can't see Hill House, but I believe it's there. I can't see it, but I'm not blind to this. I've been there, they can call me, I ask them, it's there, right? Yeah? So, yeah, it's still there. So it's still there. I can't see it, but that's what they're saying. I'm not blind to it. See, faith is not non-rational, which means it's not that it's not based on evidence. Faith isn't irrational. It doesn't go against the evidence. It is based on believing what God has said is true. Now, verse 3 is a case in point. See, take the creation of the world. Who was there when it happened? It was day 6 till anybody existed. And yet we have an account of that, don't we? Moses wrote the account. He wasn't alive till a long time after the creation of the world. How do we know that God made what we can see today out of nothing? How do we know it happened like that? Well, by faith. By faith in what? Well, by faith that Moses knew what he was talking about, that God had somehow revealed to Moses, this is how I created the world. He wrote it down and we can read it today. See, faith doesn't see, it didn't see the creation, but it's not blind. We understand it because it's based on a rational calculation of what God has said is true. Okay, the story of Noah in verse 7, that teaches us something similar. Noah's story is in Genesis 6. God was appalled at the corruption of the people on the earth, and he told Noah to build a huge boat. He said, I am going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens. See, Noah was warned about things he could not see, but he acted in faith by building the ark as God had instructed. See, he couldn't see what was promised, but it wasn't just blind faith. It was based on what God had said. Now, the reason I've labored that slightly is because I think this is a hugely misunderstood concept in our culture, isn't it? In our world today. I've already mentioned the new atheist. Listen to Richard Dawkins. Faith is blind trust without evidence. That's non-rational. And even against the evidence, irrational. And somewhere else he writes, faith is an evil because it doesn't require justification and does not tolerate argument. But that's not what the Bible means about faith. That's not what we believe faith is. Faith isn't something we believe and nobody can question because it's what I feel. That's not what faith is. Faith is reasonable. Faith is rational. It's based and it's trusting what God has said. So God tells us in the Bible that if we repent of our sin, then he forgives us on the basis of what some God, his son actually did 2,000 years ago on a cross. Now we can't see that. It doesn't even we wouldn't work that out with a sum. Yet we believe it because God has said it. God tells us in the Bible that Jesus is going to come back one day and bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. That's not something I can see, but it's something that I believe because God has said it. It's not rational. It's not irrational. It's not non-rational. It's based on what God has revealed. God says that one day he'll destroy all people and that the heavens and the earth will be places of perfect peace and righteousness. That's not something I can see. I look out in the world today, it doesn't look anything like that. It's unbelievable in one sense. But I believe it because God has said it. Faith can't see, but isn't blind. It's based on what God has said is true. The second thing I think we can see from these verses is that faith alone wins God's approval. Verse 2, this is I'm talking about the confidence and assurance. This confidence and assurance is what the ancients were commended for. The old guys, the people that we've got in this list. Now, this verse contains what commentators call a divine passive. The idea is, the ancients were commended by someone else who's not mentioned. They just commended. So who is it who's commended them? Well, God is the implied agent. He's the one who commended them. They pleased God by their confidence and assurance in his promise. As we look through this list, to each person who demonstrated faith in verses 1 to 6 is commended by God. Look at verse 4. By faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. Now that story is in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 2. Let me read out what Genesis 4 says. It says, now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. So according to Hebrews, Abel acted in faith and received God's commendation, whereas Cain didn't. But the words that I've just read out, the words of the Lord to Cain, kind of imply that Cain could have been accepted if he'd have done the right thing, but he didn't. There was clearly something about his attitude and his offering which was unacceptable. Now, my point really is this. There may have been things about the offering themselves that made them less or more or less acceptable. I mean, Genesis, the account that I read, does make a big deal of the fact that Abel offered fat portions, he had the choicest parts of the firstborn, the best thing. You know, Abel bought the best thing that he had and the best bit of the best thing that he had and gave it to God. And, you know, it doesn't really comment like that about Cain. But my point really is that in the end, what was the difference between the offering of Abel and that of Cain? What made one offering acceptable and the other offering not acceptable? Well, it was faith, wasn't it? It was the faith of the one offering. Faith led to commendation. Think about Enoch in verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it's impossible to please God because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek. Now, Enoch's story is also in Genesis chapter 5. Want to look at it later, verses 21 and 24. Let me again read something small. Let me read that out to you. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. After he became the father of Methuselah, something clearly happened then. But after that, Enoch walked faithfully with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived a total of 365 years. Enoch walked faithfully with God. Then he was able, because God took him away. See, when Genesis account says he walked faithfully with God, in Hebrews we're told that he was he pleased God and was commended by him. And this story, according to the writer of the Hebrews, shows that faith is the only way to please God and to receive his commendation. Without faith, we're told, it's impossible to please God. Now, rewards are a powerful motivator, aren't they? My parents were chucking out some old stuff recently, and I found a box of my old school things, and in it is a pile, and this is just a huge pile of commendation cards that I earned as a boy. For some reason, teachers think that a bit of paper with a commendation on it is a good motivator, and it clearly was. They were right. And that's good. It rewards demotivate and change behavior. One parenting book I read says it was silly not to use that, because that's, we have this inbuilt desire to please, an inbuilt desire for commendation. And you know what? The amazing news for us this morning is that you and I can please not only our teachers or our parents sometimes, but actually we can please God. Now, isn't that an amazing thought, that the creator of the universe, that the person who made you, can be pleased with you? Not because he's, not simply because he's made you, because he has made you, but because you yourself can bring pleasure to the God of the universe. I just find that staggering thought. You can win his commendation. You can give God pleasure. How do we do that? There's only one way. There's only one way we can give God pleasure. By faith that perseveres. If you are sat here this morning and actively trusting in God through the Lord Jesus Christ and his death on the cross for you, do you know what? You're bringing God pleasure. That's amazing. That as we trust in God, we bring pleasure to him, and we can be sure that if we earnestly seek him, that's very different, isn't it, from the God of that our culture wants to paint for us. A God where you have to win his approval by doing good things, or a God actually for whom it's impossible to win his approval, because he's just like a really strict headmaster that basically hates the people he's created. Isn't that the God that we're shown by people in the papers, in the media, people who have misunderstood the God of the Bible? The God of the Bible is one who is earnestly seeking to bless us and reward us as we earnestly seek him by faith. See, I think if we've got that, then that's a great motivator, isn't it, for us, day by day, to keep following his ways, to be persevering in faith, to be trusting the Lord Jesus, to be allowing the gospel to impact our whole lives, our thoughts, our words, the way we talk to our husband or our wife or our children, parents or our colleagues or whoever it is that we relate to. The third thing about faith is that faith sees past death. Faith sees past death. Firstly, really quickly, looking back at the story of Abel again. See, Abel ends up being brutally murdered by his brother Cain. And yet the example of his faith, we're told, lives on and teaches us, even though Abel himself has died, verse 4, and by faith Abel still speaks even though he is dead. And it could mean that, you know, even though and there are lots of inspirational characters in our world today who have died, but you leave that kind of legacy. I guess it could mean that, but I think it means a bit more than that. I think it means that faith actually results in something that doesn't end in death. I think it comes out more in Enoch, isn't it, the story of Enoch. Now, Enoch's story is remarkable anyway, but actually the way it's told in Genesis brings out the remarkableness of it even more. You see, it's in the middle of a genealogy. A genealogy that starts with Adam and ends in Noah. And at the beginning of the genealogy, we're reminded of God's great work. It says this: when God created mankind, he made them into the likeness of God. Isn't that amazing? He made man in the likeness of God. He created them, male and female, and blessed them. And he named them mankind when they were created. That's how it started. But as we all know from Genesis, 2 and 3 onwards, actually something happens, isn't it? Sin has broken its way, it seems, into God's plan. And after that, the genealogy emphasizes one thing: death. You'll remember the pattern, won't you? Somebody lives for so many years, they have children, and then they die. Then someone else lives, and they live for quite a lot of years, but eventually they die, and then they die, and then they die. And I think there are 6 deaths at least before we get to Enoch, but Enoch doesn't die. Now, why not? actually death was, we might say, like an alien intruder into God's plans. It's not a natural thing in the sense it didn't belong to God's original intent. Death is an alien intruder, but for those who walk by faith, death is not the final word. I think that's what was shown in the story of Enoch, a foretaste that actually death doesn't have to be, it's not the end actually for those who trust and walk by faith. Now I've been reading a book by Tim Keller. I've now forgot what it's called. Making Sense of God. The Making Sense of God. And it's got a great chapter on it, on death. And he makes the point that in our culture, we used to kind of get over death a little bit by showing that there was honour in giving one's life for one's country. So, you know, people, you remember the, he doesn't mention this, remember the old poster, is it World War I poster, Lord Kitchener, your country needs you, right? Your country needs you, that's a motivator for people to be kind of like, oh, I've got a duty to my country. That wouldn't work today. See, when you look at people who, when you look at kind of the adverts on TV for joining the army, they're not about duty. They're about, come and get a career. They're like, oh, come and have the greatest fun you could ever. Come and fulfill all your wildest dreams and get paid by the government for it. It's switched, isn't it? So actually, our individual kind of individualistic nature has completely twisted that on its head. Now today, people like to talk about death in different ways. We like to think that maybe actually death doesn't need to be a problem. And maybe death is a part of life. Maybe it's just a part of the sun, the circle of life. And the Lion King, I can't remember the actual context, but you know, the little lion gets a bit kind of upset that, you know, his mum or dad has killed an antelope to eat. And they're saying, well, don't worry, because you know, you eat the antelope, but then you die and you feed the grass. And another antelope comes and eats the grass. So we're all connected in the great circle of life. And that's how our culture seems to want to treat death. We try to persuade ourselves that actually death doesn't need to be feared. It's just a part of life. Don't be sad about it. It just happens. But in his book, Tim Keller makes the point that it doesn't cut it for most people today. People can't have that. When it comes to it, you just don't have that attitude towards it. You see, we know deep down that there's something deeply disturbing about death. It's an alien intruder. It's something which is painful and it separates and it's not part of God's original and good, very good plan. And the good news here is that death is not the end. There is life beyond the grave and faith can see it. That's the point of faith. Seeds beyond the grave. See, death is not part of a natural part of life. You know, it's not like there's a human life cycle. I've mentioned this before, but in one children's book that I saw where it was explaining life, it talks about the human life cycle. You know, you're born, you grow up, you have kids, and then you die, and then you're born. There's no cycle there, is there? It's a line, surely. You know, there's no, you can't. Now, if you believe in reincarnation, it's not a true circle. Okay, so you give birth to other people and that kind of stuff, but actually my life stops. I think that's the tragedy of death. And we try and persuade our children by showing them that actually, you know, it's just part of the human life cycle. It's not. It's desperately sad. But what this passage shows us is that faith helps us to see beyond. It has an existence beyond death. Death is no longer your fiercest enemy. And we've thought about that in Hebrews already, and it's for this reason. Chapter 2, verse 14, talking about Jesus, says this. Since the children, that's us, humanity, have flesh and blood, he, Jesus, too, shared in their humanity, so that by his death, he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held. Jesus has made the way through death. Death can no longer separate you if you're in him from God's purposes for you. Jesus has broken his power, and faith sees that, and faith perseveres even through that. And the good news, I think, is that if death is no longer a barrier to you and persevering faith, then nothing else is. The worst that this world can throw at us cannot separate us from our destiny in God, in Jesus. Nothing else can. Not the fiercest persecution. Nothing. Think about anything you like in this world, which is fearful. That cannot separate you and cannot prevent God from working out his purposes in you for eternity if you are in Jesus. Isn't that amazing? Confidence. Faith sees beyond the grave. Fourthly, and much quicker, faith leads to obedient, costly, and public action. Faith leads to obedient, costly, and public action. Now take Cain and Abel again. It doesn't mention in Genesis anything to do with faith. It just mentions action. And yet, Abel brought an offering, and God looked on it in favor. That's what we're told. But the offering he brought was costly. Now, he brought the best animal, and he brought the best bit and best animal, and gave it to God. He gave of his best. It was also public, because it was seen. Cain saw it, at least, and hated him for it. It was obedient, costly, and it was public. See, Noah's faith was demonstrated by building an ark in obedience to God's instructions. It was an obedient action. But it was also costly and public. Of course, I'm kind of slightly reading that in here, but it says, doesn't it, that when Noah was warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family, by his faith he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that is in keeping with faith. And I'm kind of assuming, because that seems to be the pattern of the Bible, that when you stand apart from the world, you're hated by it. It was a costly thing for him to do, and it was public. They all knew, here's righteous Noah, and here am I, unrighteous, not Noah. Now, faith and action, you see, they go together, don't they? Just like a train, engine, and its carriage. The faith is the engine that drives the carriage, that is our actions. Our actions always betray where our faith really is. And the challenge for us this morning is, what beliefs do our actions, our words, our passions, our desires, our dreams, what beliefs do they betray? Are our actions obedient? Are they costly? Are we willing to put our reputations on the line? Are we willing to put our friendships on the line? Are we desiring to live in obedience to God, even though it may cost us promotion? It may bring us sneering looks. It may exclude us from friendship groups. Are we willing? Are we willing to demonstrate costly obedience and public? Is your faith public? This can be quite countercultural. You see, faith is seen by some as being very private matter. And then you've got your faith. I've got mine. But that's not biblical faith. Faith is public, it's not private, it's visible. Cain saw Abel's sacrifice and killed him for it. Noah's obedience condemned the world. Our audience isn't Cain, but it is the world. Our audience might be our spouse, or our children, or our parents, or Christians, or not Christians. Our audience might be the parents we meet at the school gate, or the neighbours that hear us through the wall, or in the garden in the summer, or whatever it might be. Who is our audience? And does our audience hear and see a commitment to godly and costly obedience? There's a challenge there, isn't there, for us as we look at our lives. Do we think, are we able to pinpoint things that have been costly to us in some way? If not, we have to really at least ask ourselves a question whether we're being Abel's faith, and I've said condemned, commended him as righteous, but at the same time it exposed Cain's lack of righteousness, didn't it, and lack of faith. Noah's faith saved his family, made him an heir of righteousness, and at the same time condemned the world. Their righteousness has always been by faith in God's promise and in obedience to his command. Of course, the promise we have now is not salvation from a flood, but salvation from a future destruction of the whole world when Jesus comes. How do we escape that? Not by getting into an ark, not by building an ark, but by trusting in the death of Jesus on our behalf. So he is the only basis for our corrected relationship with God, the rightful righteousness. We were born, the Bible tells us, we're all born enemies of God. We're born out of relationship. We need reconciliation. We all know what it is to fall out with people, don't we? Probably. And we all know what it's like to be reconciled. Well, no, when we're born, the Bible tells us that we're out of whack with God. We need reconciliation. And that's only possible through Jesus. Noah and his family were saved by getting in the ark when the storm came. We're saved by getting in Jesus, by being found in him when the end comes. And there's no other way. Not in our good works. Nor in our service to God. We are righteous by faith alone. But also we can expect our lives, our righteous lives, to condemn others. You know, we shouldn't be surprised if people do feel condemned by us, not because we're out to condemn people with our language, but actually if we're going to live righteously, then that exposes, doesn't it, the unrighteousness of others. I'm not suggesting we should go out our way to make other people feel really bad in comparison to us. That's my point. My point simply is it's an unavoidable consequence of faith. It was for Noah. You can't stand with God and the world. If you stand with God, you condemn the world. If you stand with the world, you say that God's a liar. You can't be both. And actually, by standing with God, we will in some ways condemn the world. And some people won't like that. In fact, lots of people won't like that. The media won't like that. The news stories that we hear, the papers we read, won't like Christians, won't like the Christian community, because it makes them feel rubbish about themselves. It makes them aware of their sin. Now, we don't want people who come to Emmanuel to think, you know, you've got to have it all together to get in. By that, that would be a tragic. I feel condemned by that community because, you know, I can't be in it, but so I need to clean up my life a bit to get in. That isn't the point. Okay, we must make absolutely clear, mustn't we, that actually we don't have to have life sorted before we can get in. But it is true, isn't it, that once you belong to the Lord Jesus, your life does in some way get sorted. Isn't that just part of it? I don't mean like everything works out perfectly, but actually you become content, don't you, with your life. We can't make people think that, you know, to get into Emmanuel, you have to have a blissful marriage and three or four beautifully behaved children. Not many of us do have probably blissful marriages or three or four beautifully behaved children. But the point is, we can't give that impression. We are smell repugnant to us, but a pig would love it, wouldn't it? Isn't that the point, that a smell can be gross to one kind of one set of people and yet heaven to another? And we need to be praying, don't we, that as we live out the gospel together, that we would be having the aroma that brings life to some, and not to be discouraged if some people smell death and run a mile. Whatever happens in our society, whatever happens this year, this week, the next 10 years, we need to have faith that perseveres. That's what faith does. It demonstrates righteousness. It exposes unrighteousness by costly obedience.